It's been nearly 40 years since Molly Katzen published her groundbreaking Moosewood Cookbook, which brought vegetarian cooking to a wide audience. And now, with some 6 million copies of that and her other cookbooks sold, she is one of the best-selling cookbook authors of all time. Her latest is The Heart of the Plate, Vegetarian Recipes for a New Generation, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm delighted to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. How are you?
Now, how did you get into vegetarian cooking in the first place? Was it through the Moosewood restaurant in Ithaca?
No, it was long before that. When I was a child and growing up in a kosher home, we had one night a week that was non-meat night. It was dairy night. And that seemed the most exciting meal of the week because it was much more creative, because the center of the plate was kind of ambiguous. And my mom made a lot of kugels, and I loved it.
So when you heard about Moosewood, did you join the collective?
Oh, no. I was the founding, one of the founding owners of the restaurant. I was there for the first 5 years, so I've been gone for 35. But the very first dinner ever served there, I cooked. It was kind of a disaster, but it was a fun disaster. But it was our baby.
Well, the original Moosewood cookbook contains a lot of recipes adapted from meat dishes, like vegetable stroganoff and mushroom moussaka, also something called soy gavalt.
I know. I think that gavalt was like, oh my gosh, it worked. Yes, those were the days. And you know, I still make some of those. I do. It was a lot about mélange. It was a lot about putting whatever you could find in your kitchen into one dish.
But were you also cooking for people who'd grown up with the idea that a balanced meal was centered around a piece of meat?
Yes, and a big one, and literally at the center, geographically at the center of the plate. And vegetables were almost like decorative if they were there at all. They were very much sidelined.
Well, if you're putting together a vegetarian meal today, isn't it better to think small plates, a number of small plates,
instead of one big
thing like a big piece of meat?
Yes, and that's one of the things that I'm doing in The Heart of the Plate is I make smaller, simpler dishes, and then the creative part comes in pairing them or juxtaposing them, serving them maybe serially or maybe all sort of arranged beautifully on a plate together.
Well, isn't that what we get from other cuisines that have a lot of vegetable cooking, like Indian, Middle Eastern, Chinese, Japanese?
Absolutely. And as I was growing up, you know, sort of with this wonderful memory of that, every Thursday night we had what we called a dairy meal that was more creative. I was also very interested in ethnic cultures in many ways, through the music and the dance and the folk art and the food. And finding that in other cultures, meat was so much less of a centerpiece.
Well, then we have vegans who object to using cheese, butter, and cream.
Yes, and addressing those needs and those preferences, what I've done with The Heart of the Plate is I've, without even planning to do this, without even consciously deciding, I ended up with about a 60% vegan recipe base in the book, which is like just pure plant food, very simply prepared. And then if people want to add in a little nice touch of cheese or, you know, a nice fried egg, like a little beret on top, that's optional.
Is that because vegetarian cooking has changed a lot since Moosewood, for example, 40 years
ago? It has. And one of the things, one of the factors, I think, in influencing that is that ingredients have gotten so much better. I mean, there are so many things that are our daily ingredients now that weren't even available in American supermarkets when I first started writing cookbooks. A bottle of good olive oil was unheard of in this country at that time. Or peppers, bell peppers were green. Remember, they were always green?
And then, of course, eggplant was always the big ones, which are perfectly fine. But now we have all these Asian eggplants as well.
You can't just say one eggplant in a recipe anymore. You really need to specify. And I love that fact. I love that there's so much variety in the vegetables themselves. And there's so much of such higher quality that you need to do less to them.
Well, your subtitle here is Vegetarian Recipes for a New Generation. A lot of people these days have grown up being vegetarians.
I know. And yet, one of my, oh, forgive me, beefs with that is that I meet many vegetarians who don't necessarily.
One of your broccolis is what?
You know, I'm going to switch over to that, Leonard. I like that. One of my broccolis with that is that I meet many vegetarians for whom the vegetarian label is more about meat than it is about vegetables, as in anything but or keep it off my plate, but in fact who don't necessarily eat many vegetables at all. So my job is to make vegetables compelling and craveable and beautiful so people want them, and they might eat meat or not, They might eat meat less often. They might not eat it at all. But they're falling in love with vegetables is my goal. I want to get everybody just infatuated with the plant foods.
Well, the recipes in this book are more sophisticated, lighter, and generally lower in fat than we have seen in the past.
Well, lower in bad fat anyway. I mean, I'm a little bit of a fiend, if you can be a little bit of a fiend, with olive oil. I have this kind of olive oil issue at home that if I'm down to less than half a bottle, I have to go get another one for backup.
But you have to use it up really fast. Otherwise, doesn't olive oil spoil? Once you open the bottle,
right,
it starts deteriorating.
I buy olive oil in dark bottles and keep it dark and, you know, away from air. But I use it so quickly that that's almost moot.
Now, we have put some of the recipes on our show page, some of the recipes from this book, citrusy beets, spinach, mushroom, mac and cheese, and Brussels sprout gratin with potatoes and spinach. I guess we could have chosen a lot of other things just as easily, but I think mac and cheese is one of those things that immediately perks people's ears up.
Mac and cheese is one of those foods to which we have an emotional attachment from childhood. And the psychological love of food to me is as important as the nutritional concerns or the our physiological needs. Just we have such a psychological and emotional tie to mac and cheese in this culture. So that's part of my kind of subversive plan that I call the Great Food Flip, where I'm sneaking more and more vegetables. I mean, they're not incognito. They're visible. But this mac and cheese is filled with spinach and mushrooms. And I make the white sauce with beer, which is really fun. It's not required, but if you're drinking a beer, you can drink half and put the other half in your mac and cheese, and it's really yummy.
Recipes like olive oil, buttermilk, sherbet, and strawberries on green salad, or charred or collard wrapped polenta chili tamale packages do seem fairly adventurous.
You know, they seem, when I hear you say it, I actually get hungry myself, but I also hear that it sounds quite complicated. But in fact, I break it down so that this is not only for advanced cooks. I try to walk beginners through those charred packages that are filled with polenta, and they're very popular, actually.
And as we mentioned earlier, people are concerned about menus because there isn't just one. These are not just dish-centric. You provide whole menus. Do people feel the need to be guided in that way?
I think so. In fact, I felt that it was so important that I actually put the menus, of which there are 35, and about half of those are vegan, right up in the front of the book. So when you first open it, here, this is how to pair this with this and all the different kind of combinations, because the dishes themselves tend in this book to be smaller and lighter than the bigger casseroles from my Moosewood cookbook and Enchanted Broccoli Forest days. So I think people need some guidance as to what to serve with what. But once people read these menus, I really hope that they will kind of make up their own as well.
Do you recommend drinking wines with these dishes or beer?
I do, although I didn't specifically recommend pairings. But absolutely, I think one of the ways that vegetarian, the kind of whole concept of it and the ethos of it has grown and deepened is that it's not considered a kind of remorse cuisine anymore, where it's not ascetic. It's more sensual, and it's quote unquote gourmet. So wines and beer can definitely be paired.
There was that old feeling that many vegetarians just were not very sensual. They didn't really like food all that much, and so it didn't matter. But now vegetarian cooking is becoming as sensuous as any other kind of cooking.
And one of the things I love is that currently all of my chef friends take the most pride in their vegetable preparations. The thing that they're really touting on their menus is how they do their broccoli or how they do their kale or their Brussels sprouts.
And then people like the late Charlie Trotter actually started a whole tasting menu separate from the other menu that's just vegetarian, and we've seen that in a lot of other restaurants recently.
He was such a trailblazer in that respect.
My guest is Molly Katzen, whose latest book is The Heart of the Plate, Vegetarian Recipes for a New Generation. Thanksgiving is just 6 days away, and it often presents a dilemma for vegetarians and their families. Do you have a menu for a vegetarian or vegan Thanksgiving dinner?
I do. I mean, we'll start with the main dish because people tend to get a little bit stressed out about, let me put it this way, I think people are done facing down tofurkeys. I think that kind of meat substitute, that meat analog kind of style is hopefully behind us. And
but it doesn't taste like turkey.
That's, I know. What is, do you know?
If you're going to do a substitute, then at least come up with something that really tastes like the original.
I vote for real food. And I also want to just say, as a pep talk to vegetarians, and my definition of vegetarian, by the way, is an adjective that describes the plate of food as vegetarian, not so much a noun that identifies the person. So people who prefer not to eat meat, at least sometimes, or maybe even most of the time, have a heyday with Thanksgiving, normally with the side dishes, because they're off the hook. I mean, there's so many of them, the orange vegetable and the green vegetable and the cranberries. And this year, because it's also Hanukkah, you know, we'll be putting cranberry sauce on our latkes, which will be fantastic and beautiful. But still, sometimes there just really is a need for a main dish. And so moving away from the analog and the tofurkey, I really vote for stuffing a beautiful vegetable vessel with a beautiful pilaf. And two different ways you can do this with recipes from the heart of the plate. One would be to roast, I know Melissa was just talking about roasting a delicato squash, and absolutely do that, and then fill the cavity, which is just born to be stuffed, I call it, with a pilaf made from couscous, quinoa, and carrots with some roasted almond oil. I love roasted nut oils. And top it with some gorgeous, beautiful, gaudy pink pickled onions. And a stuffed squash with that kind of pilaf is just, it's so satisfying. And then the gravy, because everyone needs gravy. So I have a vegan, gluten-free mushroom gravy in the book that will satisfy the gravy need, I hope.
Well, mushrooms often satisfy the meat need in mm-hmm. people. But a lot of things that we associate with non-meat dishes, like couscous or risotto, polenta, people often cook with chicken stock because they feel it gives it more flavor, that little bit of protein. How do you get around that? Vegetable stocks just don't give you as much burst of flavor.
I would say use a lot of mushrooms. And in fact, it's not so much that you would cook the mushrooms in water as you would other stocks, but let the mushrooms express themselves. So steam some mushrooms, salt them, and cook them with the top, a tight top on the pan, and they will express their own juices and squeeze out that liquid. And that becomes a very potent kind of mushroom-flavored liquid that can then go into your gravy. The other thing you can do is soak dried mushrooms. And then the soaking water really picks it up and is a vehicle that goes far.
Many vegetarians are having Thanksgiving dinner with their carnivorous families. They just avoid the turkey and just eat the sides. But it doesn't feel as satisfying.
So
what should happen? Do families where there's one person who's a vegetarian have to make two dinners?
No, I would say that just add on. I see it as a big kind of a plus rather than a minus. So just make a little bit more room on the table and either make that stuffed delicata squash that I just described, or you can grill some portobello mushrooms and fill them with a farro and Tuscan white bean combination, which is delicious and meaty and satisfying. Again, that would also go with a gravy. And one of the things that I think stresses people often about Thanksgiving, whether they're having turkey or not, is how cluttered both their time and their kitchen become. The time becomes a crunch at the end to get it to serve everything hot at the same time. And then oven space and counter space become a huge issue. And one of the emphases in almost all of my recipes in the heart of the plate is that they're very sturdy. And I mean, not heavy, but sturdy. And they can very happily withstand being made ahead and refrigerated and then reheated. And another thing I do is I relax about the final temperature. You don't have to see visible steam coming off of it. As long as it's a comfortable, warm temperature, it's acceptable at the table.
So are you cooking Thanksgiving dinner?
I'm actually potlucking with my friends, which we always do. And normally I'm pie lady because I have this just, I just love making pastries. I have an inner pastry chef that's just yearning to get out. So I usually make pies. But my assignment this year was to make a bunch of vegetable dishes for my new book. So I'm making a Brussels sprouts dish that I call pot sticker Brussels sprouts that are they're very well done, kind of, you know, golden brown Brussels sprouts with very fresh, crunchy onions. And also a green bean that's a twist on the almonds with sesame instead of almonds.
A number of people I know have been told by their doctors, vegetarians, that they were going to have to eat meat because they'd become anemic. How do you get around that?
Well, anemic is iron deficiency, so Some of the vegetables that have iron, the dark green leafy vegetables, spinach and kale, which is such a superstar vegetable now. So all the dark leafy greens, beet greens, cook them up with olive oil, and they're very high in iron. Also, lentils are good for iron. But people who eat absolutely no animal products at all, vegans, do need to get a vitamin B12 supplement, which is easy to get.
Where did you get the title of your book, The Heart of the Plate, from?
It's a multiple meaning. First of all, the heart health of eating plant foods. The heart of the plate indicating the center of the plate that I'm trying to shift from being one main dish, whether it's a hunk of meat or a vegetarian casserole. So the heart of the plate, kind of a moving target, a new definition of what it means to have a plate of dinner. And also because my very wonderful editor, Rex Martin, pretty much told me to write from my heart and get out of my way and just write what I really wanted to say, and I was so grateful for that. So that reflects all those meanings.
And the book is called The Heart of the Plate, Vegetarian Recipes for a New Generation. We have posted a number of the recipes from the book on our show page at WNYC.org. Citrusy beets, spinach, mushroom, mac and cheese, and Brussels sprout gratin with potatoes and spinach. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And my great thanks to Molly Katzen for being on our show today.
Thank you so much, Leonard. Happy Thanksgiving.